This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio. Today, I'm delighted to have with me in a makeshift backstage studio, Michael Franti, the musician, poet, and human rights activist. Leader of the band Spearhead, Franti's been involved in everything from anti-death penalty work to the battle in Seattle and the anti-Iraq war movement. His albums include Home, Stay Human, Everyone Deserves Music, Chocolate Superhighway, and Songs from the Front Porch. He hosts an annual Power of the Peaceful Festival in San Francisco, and now he's made a prize-winning film called I Know I'm Not Alone. Michael Franti, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
Why did you decide to do a film?
Well, one day I was sitting around at a gig in our tour bus and watching CNN, and I was hearing these generals and politicians explaining with very high-tech graphics, very slick, the economic cost and the political cost of the war in Iraq. And after watching them explain the use of this weapon called the MOAB, which stood for the mother of all bombs, a 5,000-pound bomb that could explode six stories below the earth, I sat there thinking, well, gosh, I live in a city that's San Francisco. It's about the size of Baghdad. And if someone dropped one of those in my town, I'd be kind of concerned about what was happening with the people there. So I noticed on CNN during the whole coverage of the war, I never saw one Iraqi person.
It's always the generals they have.
Yeah, I never saw one body of a U.S. soldier, of an Iraqi person. So I said, I want to go there. I want to see the human face and the human cost of this war.
When did you go?
I went in June of 2004.
And what kind of human cost did you see?
Well, I saw pain and suffering on both sides. The first was the devastation of the actual air raids, the explosions of buildings, and so many buildings are knocked out. And then came the effects of the occupation, which is the intensity of the anger that's built up each day as U.S. soldiers go into each neighborhood and break down doors, arrest people, try to find weapons.
And this is something that we don't see and we don't really feel, because mm-hmm. I think a lot of Americans still think, you know, we went over there as liberators and we should be treated as liberators, and can't understand why Iraqis don't view us that way.
Yeah. Well, one of the main reasons is just that the quality of life is so much worse today than it was during the time of Saddam. People hated Saddam. I mean, they did not like the tyranny, the violent oppression. But they had water, they had electricity, they had jobs, they had relative safety on the streets, and now they have none of that. And so people there are very angry, and they say, if America really came here to liberate us, then why don't they leave? And, you know, there's been a lot of talk in this country, well, what happens if we leave? You know, if we just pull out, then we've left this situation where we have Kurds and Shias and Muslims and Sunnis all fighting each other.
And people say all hell would break loose. So what's your answer to that?
Well, speaking to Iraqis, their answer was the same answer that Gandhi gave the British when it was clear that the British needed to leave India, which is that we do have this problem between Hindus and Muslims in India. But when you leave, it will be our problem to take care of. And we rebuilt this nation after the first Iraq war, the Gulf War, with no help. In fact, sanctions against our nation. And we're capable of rebuilding it again. And that's their attitude. My personal belief is that we need something more than just a pullout. We need to create an international body of nations who are willing to assist, to provide economic, humanitarian, and security assistance to get that nation on its feet.
Michael Franti, do you think other nations would pitch in if the U.S. pulled out?
Well, I think it's a hard sell at this point. You know, we did everything that we could to turn our back on every nation that was saying, hey, maybe you should think twice about this.
In fact, it was Bush's proudest moment. He said to Bob Woodward, going to the U.N. in September of 2002 and just telling every country off. He said that he loved that more than anything else he did in his whole presidency. Isn't that weird?
Yeah, it's crazy. So now we have a whole world who, you know, has... who has empathy, but who's going to really be willing to send your sons and daughters into Iraq? Who's going to be really willing to invest the billions of dollars that are required? And now, meanwhile, back home, we have crisis in this country of catastrophic proportion as a result of these hurricanes that have been happening. And it's been a real lifting of the veil. And as I've traveled with this film, you know, I've been in the South, I've been in North Carolina, and I've been in, I was in Kansas in the central states yesterday. And to hear people talk now about the war is very different than when I had just come back in June of 2004. People say, you know, I was talking to a taxi driver yesterday in North Carolina. He said, had my son died in Afghanistan, I would have said, okay, they were going after Al-Qaeda. But if I had a son who was in Iraq and died there, I would be on the president's doorstep beating the door down.
Yeah, I don't think Americans were prepared for 2,000 dead U.S. soldiers and 15,000 wounded. And what about the Iraqis who died? Anywhere by some accounts between 25,000 more and 100,000.
Yeah.
Did you talk to families who lost loved ones in this war?
I did.
And how are they dealing with that?
Well, they have a hatred. You know, they have an anger. And they say, you know, they remember that there was a time when the U.S. was going to support an upheaval to take Saddam out after the first Gulf, or during the first Gulf War, and it never happened, you know. And so there was already a mistrust of America from that time, but now Iraqis just feel like, especially since Bush has been reelected again. Because when I was there, it was June of 2004, right before the election. So they said, "Well, we know that America is not the people of America are not represented by Bush any more than the people of Iraq were represented by Saddam. But if you elect him again, we're not giving you the benefit of the
doubt." So that was a real slap in the face.
Yeah.
You met with some Iraqi poets and writers and musicians. What was their experience under Saddam, and what are they hoping for now?
Well, their experience under Saddam, as you'll see in the film, it was one of oppression. There was one poet in our film who shows his fingers that were mangled during the war, and he says, despite Saddam sending me to war and my hands looking, you know, with fingers missing, if they cut off my hands, I'd still write with my teeth. And they're that desirous of freedom, that committed to creating something in their nation that they've never had before.
I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm speaking with Michael Franti, the musician and poet, and now filmmaker. His film is called I Know I'm Not Alone. Where'd you get the title?
Well, there was been a lot of times in the last 5 years since Bush got into office where I felt alone. I felt like, well, am I the only person in this country who feels that after September 11th, maybe there should have been a more constructive strategy than bombing the crap out of other nations? I never thought that that would bring us safety. I always thought there should be a question is, why is it that the other nations are angry at the U.S.? Why is it that the Muslim world feels that the United States is representing governments in the Arab states that are oppressive? And that's where this anger is coming from. And I thought we should be addressing those issues and looking into those issues rather than just going to a strictly military solution.
When you were in Iraq, you also, I understand, talked with U.S. soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
What was that experience like?
Well, the first interaction I had with U.S. soldiers was at a gate to get into the Sheraton Hotel. And just as I was talking to them, a mortar blew up about a couple blocks away from us. And so I saw these guys go into ready mode and see, you know, both how prepared they are in terms of their training, but also how afraid they are in terms of their youth and inexperience in war. And, you know, I spent time in their bar when they're off duty. I walk into a bar full of guys holding a beer in one hand with an M16 sitting right next to him and say, "Hey, I'm here to sing songs about peace and love." You know,
how'd they react to that?
They were like, well, you know, it was really scary for me. because I've always been so outspoken about my political views of my songs. But I just really, after speaking to a friend who was with me, she said, you know, Michael, it's not really so important what you say or what you sing. What's important is that these guys know that you came all the way to be here with them on this night and just share this time with them. And so that's what I did. And it ended up being a great experience, I think, for both of us, because I got to see what it was like to be in a soldier's shoes, to be somebody who, one guy told me, I signed up for the Army on September 12th, 2001, the day after September 11th, because I wanted to represent my country, fight for freedom. And now I'm here in Iraq, and there were no weapons of mass destruction. Saddam was never found to be involved with 9/11, so why am I here risking my life every day?
Did any of the soldiers still think they were avenging 9/11 by being there?
None of them said that they thought they were avenging 9/11, but they did feel like Saddam was somebody who was worth taking out. And my response to them was, well, then who next? Do we go after, you know, the Saudi royal family for their human rights abuses? Do we go to Haiti, to other nations in South America, to North Korea, around the world, policing the whole planet, you know? And so, you know, we talked about that, you know, just to what level does... do they, as soldiers, want to be part of a world police force? And most of them said they didn't want to be.
Yeah, I imagine they didn't. I mean, I read that you brought some of the U.S. soldiers together with Iraqi DJs or Iraqi musicians and had a party at the Sheraton Hotel.
Yeah.
How'd you arrange that?
Well, there's a radio station. It's the first independent radio station in Iraq. And it's in the same building as the Sheraton Hotel where these soldiers were staying. But these soldiers didn't know the radio station was in there. So I told them about it, and they said, well, let's go down and hang out. And so we had a party, and it was the first time Iraqi soldiers, these particular Iraqis and these particular soldiers, had ever spent time together. You know,
because it seems to me that the interaction between U.S. soldiers and Iraqis is confrontational every step of the way.
It's confrontational, but you do have Iraqi defense forces who are working with U.S. soldiers, and so there is a camaraderie that does occur on that level. But I think to a lot, I wouldn't say all, but to a lot of Iraqi civilians, they view those soldiers as colluding with the enemy. You know, after I spent a week in Baghdad, I then moved on to Israel and Palestine. I traveled throughout the West Bank and Gaza Strip.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, I wanted to see, you know, I saw the effects of occupation, of what 1 year of occupation did to the nation of Iraq. So I wanted to see what it was like to have three generations of occupation in the West Bank and how that affected people. And so I spent time in refugee camps speaking with Palestinians. I spent time with Israeli soldiers at checkpoints talking about their experiences. I went into Jerusalem and spoke with Jewish families and business people about an experience that they had in one neighborhood where there was a suicide bombing occurred. And I talked to Palestinian families who'd had their homes destroyed in order to build new settlements. And I found that occupation didn't work for either side. You know, you have one group of people, Palestinians, who live in third world conditions with an army in their face every day, have to wait hours and hours to get from place to place going through checkpoints. Then on the other side, you have a very much like American style standard of living in Israel, but people live in fear every day of attacks. And so in the film I tried my best to show both sides and to show that really that, I guess the overall message of the film is that war and occupation doesn't create stability.
You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm speaking with Michael Franti, the musician, poet, human rights activist, and now filmmaker. The film we're talking about is his prize-winning film called I Know I'm Not Alone. When you were in Israel and in the occupied territories, I guess it was in the occupied territories you were shot at?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was traveling through Hebron, which is in the West Bank, and playing guitar in an open-air market for kids on the street. So I had a group of about 15 or 20 kids who are following me. And just as we passed this intersection, a group of Israeli soldiers came through and started firing their weapons above the heads of the crowd to just disperse the crowd. And everybody went running, and they called for curfew, which is almost the day of the occurrence where they impose curfew. They don't really say why, or there's no reasoning behind it, but they have a, you know, a 24-hour curfew. And for a lot of families living in Hebron during the first 2 years of this most recent intifada, they spent 80% of their time under curfew, living indoors.
And as you did in Iraq, evidently in this film in Israel and the occupied territories, you tried to bring the Israeli soldiers this time together with some of the Palestinians. How were you able to bring that off?
Well, we were in a village of Jayus, and there had been an argument that broke out at the gate, which is the separation wall that's being built now between the West Bank and Israel, and so these villagers in Jayus, they've been separated from their land that they farm, and so they have to go through a gate every day just to get to their olive trees. And so there was a argument that broke out at the gate between the soldiers and some other people about where the wall was originally supposed to be built, because when they built the wall, they seized a lot of Palestinian land, which is why the UN High Court has recently ruled the wall to be illegal. We later went back to that gate, and I sort of got the people from Jayus village and the soldiers to come together to talk. And an amazing thing happened. The Israeli soldiers said, you know, we know that Palestinian people don't hate us, and we don't hate Palestinians. And it's only when religion comes into politics that we have these problems. And the Muslim Palestinian said, you know, if you were to come into my village, I would invite you into my house to have tea, and we could sit down and we could talk about this.
So that's room for hope there.
Yeah. Now, that's the thing I saw over and over again, was that where people had the opportunity to interact, they created friendships. And it's only the policies that are set by the governments that are keeping the people from interacting. And so that's what I kept hearing over and over again. We want our governments to create a policy that we can just get along and learn to interact with each other.
But, and yet, especially, I guess in both cases, Israel and in Iraq, it doesn't look like the governments, at least the U.S. government, is pushing policies in that direction.
No.
What do you think is going to take here in the United States to get the government to...
Well, I think
there.
That I think that here it's going to take a new administration. I think that the Bush administration is so stubborn and so arrogant in everything that they do that it's hard for them to shift gears. I think in the situation of Israel and Palestine, there is some movement that's happening. Since the passing of Arafat, Sharon, who's a very military leader, has orchestrated the pullout of settlements from Gaza. And, you know, there's a lot of people who are on the left who say, well, it's just a small thing. It's not really a big step. But it is that is one of the first steps of the Oslo Peace Accord and to get the peace process moving there.
And there was jubilation in Gaza when the Israelis left.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, one thing I learned on this trip was that I'm not on the side of Americans or Iraqis or Israelis or Palestinians. I'm on the side of the peacemakers from whatever country they come from. So anybody who's willing to work towards peace, we have to learn to be supportive of them, even if it's Bush, you know, even if it's people that we feel we, you know, are against our own beliefs. We have to support working for peace.
Michael Franti, I read that you said you did not want to make a political movie, but it sounds like a political movie to me.
Well, it's not a political movie in the sense that a Michael Moore movie might be about, you know, the Bush administration and the policies and the politicians. This is a movie that's about people, and it's told through the everyday occurrences of people, you know. And so in some ways the politics play out, but it's more about the heavy metal band in Baghdad that I interviewed who has to use telephone wire to put on their guitar strings.
How'd you find them?
Just through word of mouth. I asked, where are the musicians? And I feel like things like that, a band has to use the telephone wire to make a string for the guitar, speaks more about what's happening with the war than generals or politicians explaining the policies.
And like the writer who would write with his teeth, too.
Yeah.
I mean, there seems to be a theme here of the role of art and music transcending these political battles and boundaries. Did you see that when you were visiting other musicians and poets and writers?
I did. And the thing that this trip really did was restore my faith in music. Everywhere I went with the guitar, it was like the walls would just drop instantly. People, you know, it didn't matter if it was soldiers or kids in hospitals with their limbs blown off. People would smile, people would clap, people would sing along, and people were happy to experience music. And then after that, we would talk. And it wasn't just my music, it was the other music that I heard along the way, the Iraqi music or the Palestinian music, or this band Sheva that was a group of Israeli and Palestinian musicians who'd come together with the message of peace. Wherever there was music, there was dialogue.
And for people who want to see this movie or find out more mm-hmm. about the movie, I Know I'm Not Alone, how would they?
You can go to iknowimnotalone.com, which will tell you where screenings are. And this fall, we're also going to be, once we get the copies of the DVD started rolling, we will be inviting people to hold home screenings and spread the word through the word of mouth.
And it's not just a film. You created a lot of songs while mm-hmm. you were over there.
Yeah.
Did you make them while you were there, or did you make them when you came back? What was your process?
I wrote a lot of songs while I was there. But when I came back, I wrote even more. And the experience of editing the movie and reliving some of the experiences. Ironically, I've been known in my career for writing songs that rail against the system. But having had this experience of being in war, I wrote songs that were about personal relationships, connection between people. And
so it made you quieter in a way.
In a way. I mean, there's still some loud songs, but I just thought it was really interesting that before going over there, I wrote a lot of songs that said, you know, F the war, F the system. And when I got there, I realized that that's not really what the war is about. The war is really about people trying to connect with one another, or somebody trying to figure out where they're going to get water for this evening's meal, or when are the lights going to come back on. And so songs that were coming from that perspective just seem more pertinent.
Well, maybe you can't beat war with more anger and more violence. That might be the lesson. You were going to play a song for mm-hmm. us, I think. Do you want to introduce it?
Yeah, this is a song. It's called See You in the Light, and it's just a song that I wrote about my own personal journey as a musician and as somebody who was trying to my best to, you know, serve the planet through my music and then do the thing that we all want to do, which is help the world and pay our rent. I've been traveling down this river. So many rocks pop up in my sight. I got to make some quick decisions. Should I go left or should I go right? I pray for guidance and protection. Keeps my boat watertight. And I know if I just keep on believing, every little thing's all gonna be alright. But when I wake up in the morning, I hope I see you in the light. And when I wake up in the morning, I hope I see you in the light. Yoo-hoo. Vampires gather round me, angling to take a bite. They wanna drink my blood of courage and try to take away my fight. But no, 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 they can't do that. For one truth I learned in life, you want to scare away the vampires, you simply got them. When I wake up in the morning, I hope I see you in the light. When I wake up in the morning, I hope I see you in the light, yeah. In the morning, the morning. In the morning, the morning. in the morning, the morning, in the morning, when my time is done. I did some right, I did some wrong. Call my name to kingdom come. Spread my wings in flight. I hope that when my day is over, my love, I see you in the light. But when I wake up in the morning, I hope I see you in the light. When I wake up in the morning, I hope I see you in the light. In the morning, in the morning, in the morning, in the morning.
In the morning, in the morning,
in the morning, in the morning, in the morning, in the morning.
That's Michael Franti playing his new song, unrecorded at this point, called See You in the Light. What album is that going to be on?
We're doing two albums simultaneously right now. One is called Yell Fire, and it's a loud, funky, spearhead kind of reggae, funk, and rock album. And then we're doing another album that's called Cool Water, which is kind of the flip side, which is all acoustic music. And I'm working on it with a lot of different musicians from around the world, a lot of different people from Tibet, from China, from Africa, South America, from the Middle East. It'll all be roots, instruments, and acoustic guitar.
And are you playing from those albums when you're traveling around, or you're playing mostly old stuff?
Yeah, all these songs were in some way inspired from my experience in going to the Middle East and making this film. So they'll both be companion pieces to the film, and they're, a lot of the songs are featured in the film.
Michael Franti, for people, again, who want to see this film, I Know I'm Not Alone, where would you send them?
Either to spearheadvibrations.com, which is our website, or to iknowimnotalone.com.
And just finally here, before we leave, do you have any thoughts as to the direction that this country's going in and what people need to do here in the United States?
Well, you know, if you look historically, we have these periods in history, the Great Depression, the Dust Bowl, the Civil Rights Movement, the Gay Rights Movement. And I really feel like right now we're entering into a new period that I call the Great Dialogue, which has come about as a result of the last years of this administration. And now with this hurricane, it's like this veil has been lifted and people are starting to say, what type of nation do we really want to be? It's not about Republican or Democrat, left and right. It's, do we want to be a nation that is feared by the rest of the world for our military power and not take care of things back home? Or do we want to be a nation that takes care of things happening here and from our overflow and from our benevolence creates economic assistance, social justice, and prosperity for the whole planet?
Well, we sure need that dialogue instead of some of the sound bites and fury that we hear all the time. Yeah. Michael Franti, thanks so much for being my guest today on Progressive Radio.
Thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.